Ladies and gentlemen, this is Jay Booksbaum. You know me probably from wine and spirits, but I want to tell you something. Even though I'm in that area of expertise, you're about to hear from Rahama Bistritsky-Klapman, who runs MASS, Mothers and Fathers Aligned Saving Kids. They're in their 20th anniversary. They've got over 45,000 families that they've helped over the years. It's an amazing program. It's called Family Matters. And if you've got any issues with bullying or alcohol or substance abuse or any other kind of abuse, they're your place to go. I'm really excited to introduce you all to Rahama Bistritsky-Klapman here on Dev Brenner's Talkline Communications Network every Thursday night at 9 o'clock. Listen to Rahama and Family Matters.
Good evening. And tonight's show, we have Dr. Rona Novick, the Dean of the Israeli Graduate School, Yeshiva University, and a specialist in bullying. So many years, Dr. Novick, that you've been forging ahead, trying to make the schools and the community take off its mask to understand the effects of bullying. I want to welcome you, Dr. Novick.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Rahama.
And we have with us, once again, Gerianna from Paradigm Treatment Center, and she's an executive director and for the new program that should be opening in New York. And I want to welcome you, Gerianna.
Thank you very much, Rahama. It's an honor to be back. Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Novick, tonight's show, we wanted to talk about bullying. And I wanted to open the show to discuss first about younger kids getting bullied in school, in the playground. If you can talk about elementary age kids getting bullied, please.
Sure. First of all, I love being introduced as the expert on bullying. What I'd really like to be introduced is as the expert on bully prevention. I'm certainly not in favor. I'm diligently working with schools and communities so that we create places not only where we prevent bullying, but where we raise conscientious, responsible, and kind social engineers, social citizens. That being said, when we talk about bullying, and particularly with younger students, we have to be mindful that there is a great deal of aggressive and inappropriate behavior that happens with younger students that is just that. It's aggression and it's inappropriate, but it isn't bullying. So let's start by defining our terms. Bullying is the deliberate abuse of power to cause harm to another. The three critical elements that distinguish it from other types of aggression is, one, it's deliberate. It's not, I accidentally bumped into you at the playground. And, by the way, children will say, well, I did it on accident, but we all know, as adults, when it's happened time and time again, quote, by accident, that it's not really accidental. So the first issue is that it's not accidental, that it's purposeful. The second is that bullying involves an abuse of power. Now, some children have power, particularly in elementary school, just by virtue of their size. A fourth grader is much bigger than a second grader, and if that fourth grader goes onto the playground and bosses all the second graders around and says, you know, go away, this is my area, you can't be here, the tendency is to think that that's bullying. But the last component of the definition is very important here, and that's it's a deliberate abuse of power to cause harm to another person. Let's take that playground example again. The fourth grader says to the second graders, you can't go on the slide. This is my slide. I'm going on the slide. Now, that might sound exactly like bullying. But in fact, if the fourth grader loves the slide, then it's not so much about being mean to the second graders and making them miserable. It's that this is the only slide, and I want it all to myself. Not acceptable behavior, not nice behavior. But think of how different that is from a fourth grader where there are plenty of swings available, but when a second grader goes to the empty swing next to them, says, no second graders allowed on the swings. I'm the boss of the swings. There, the issue is not that the fourth grader wants the swing. They simply want to make the second grader feel less than, to deny them access, and to make them feel bad. And that's the typical picture and the true picture of bullying. Once again, I want to make the distinction that neither behavior is acceptable. Whether a fourth grader is doing it because they love the slide and want it all to themselves, or whether they're doing it to hurt innocent second graders, all of it is behavior we need to work on. The reason the distinction has value or importance is if the reason I'm doing it is because I love the slide, then maybe what an educator is going to do is come up with a rotation for when, you know, turn-taking for the slide, or maybe open up another playground area with another slide in it, or bring in a small slide for the littler kids. But if this is all about just being mean and controlling and making the other child feel bad, and I could make all the scheduling permutations that I want, and that fourth grader is still going to do the same thing, is going to make that second grader feel miserable. Now, the reality is that all of the research literature on bullying tells us that the peak years for bullying are upper elementary and middle school years, fourth to eighth grade. But what I will tell you is that I am seeing incredibly precocious behavior, and I'm seeing even in preschool children mimic the bullying that they see on TV, in their own homes, in their families. And I'm seeing even preschoolers say things like, you know, we made a club, and you can't be in our club because you're not wearing a pink shirt, and only girls with pink shirts can be in our club. And so what used to be thought of as a middle school kind of problem, we now recognize is happening at much younger ages. It's not surprising also that I picked off the top of my head a playground example, and Rahama, you mentioned playgrounds. It's not surprising because bullying is most likely to happen in the places and times when structure and adult supervision is the most minimal. So bullies don't tend to bully their peers while the teacher's teaching, or it's going to be less likely and more subtle. But when the teacher can't have eyes on everything on the playground or is otherwise occupied, that's when it's more likely to happen. That means playgrounds, bathrooms, the bus, the school bus, unsupervised time is one of the greatest challenges.
Dr. Novick, thank you. What are some of the signs a child is being bullied when there is no adult and the parent's not around? How can a parent be aware? What are some of those signs if the child doesn't have the vocabulary or afraid to tattletale,
right,
and the parent doesn't even know what's going on yet?
What I would say, and this is going to be the same answer to the next question you're going to ask. Your follow-up question is, how do you know if your child is being a bully? Or, you know, how do you know if your child is a bystander? That's the next logical question, right? So
yes.
the answer is, in some ways, begins the same, and that is that as parents, and I'd even go a step further, as educators, as teachers, we have to create a very clear, habit, a very clear ritual and routine of talking with our children and our students about social connections. We have to ask, you know, when your child comes home at the end of the day and gets off the school bus or out of carpool or walks into your door, you know, the typical question is, how was your day? Do you have homework? What did you learn in math? What teacher was nice? But we have to ask, who did you play with? We have to ask, what did you do at recess? Who hangs out with who on the playground? And what do the other girls do when your group is coloring? We have to prod those and mine for data and information about what goes on in the social lives of our children, not just to get bullying information, but to have a context. So we should know if our child comes home every single day and says, I played with Shira. Every day, I played with Shira. Then to me, as a parent, part of our job is to say, well, what about playing with some other girls, too? And if every single day your child comes home and says, I sat by myself, or I didn't play, or I didn't want to, they were playing catch, but I didn't want to play. So those are red flags when you're getting the same story every single day with no diversity, and when your child is saying things like, I didn't want to join. I didn't, because some children won't say they wouldn't let me, or they teased me, but if you're hearing over and over again, I didn't want to, I didn't want to, I didn't want to, that raises some alarm bells. But again, yes. regardless of whether your child is on the receiving or the giving end, you'll be better positioned to know who your child is socially, what their strengths and weaknesses are, if you're having these discussions on a regular basis. There's another really important thing that these discussions do. Every time we give something airtime in our family, every time we talk about it, we send our children the message that this is something that's important to us. If we ask our child every single day, do you have homework? What did you get on the test? How did you do? Did you study enough? We're communicating to our children that we value their academic skills and talents and their academic activities. If every time we see our child, we say, did you draw me a picture? What did you draw today? Oh, my gosh, I love, can we put that in the refrigerator door? We communicate that we value artistic talents. So one way that we raise caring children is that when they come in the door from school and when we ask them, so who did you play with today? So who did you include in your games? So what person did you make feel better today? Is there a chance you hurt anyone's feelings today? What would you do about that? What do you think about that? We're communicating our value of their being socially caring and kind individuals. And I think that's a really important message that our children have to get. They have to hear from us that we see this as a core part of who they are, and just the same way that we will be proud of them when they bring home an A+ or a beautiful painting, we will also be proud of them when they bring us a story of their kindness and of their social concern for others.
Dr. Novick, there are children, there are parents that call in on the MASK helpline that parents describe that their children have headaches, stomach aches, physical ailments, they're moody, they come home depressed from school, and only after the child gets into therapy did the parent find out that the child was being bullied.
Yes.
So
this is not uncommon. However, the delicate issue here is you're talking about after the fact, once we already know the child has symptoms, and then we discover that bullying happened. It is not a 100% one-to-one correlation. There are many children who have somatic complaints, headaches, stomach aches, for other reasons at school. And there are many children who are bullied who never exhibit those somatic complaints. So, yes, it is something to raise a red flag and to be concerned about, but I would neither say, well, my child can't possibly be bullied because they're trotting off to school with no headaches. Nor would I say, well, they have headaches, therefore, 100% clarity, I'm sure, that bullying is happening. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, yes. Dr. Novick, this is Jerry, and I had a question that, being a parent myself of a young child in elementary school, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this question, but what, other than the communication between parent and child, which I agree wholeheartedly with you, it's so critically vital, important that we are good listeners and good communicators with our children, what can we do as parents as part of reaching out to the school in the most effective way possible to continue the conversation around bullying and share as parents, as part of a family and a community, what can we learn from each other? So what would you suggest in terms of the most powerful way to get the communication ignited with the schools, the teachers, the principals?
Right. So first, much in the same way that I think it's important that children know that we value this, I think it's important that our schools and our children's teachers know that we value this. And that means that our line of communication with the school around our children's social lives and social development shouldn't only happen the day that bullying happens. It's at every parent-teacher conference, at every communication, we should not only ask, and how are they doing in math or in Chumash or in, a particular subject area, but we should ask, and are they a good friend? And are they integrated socially? And do they seem to be nice to others? Because that's something that we want to emphasize. And we also, in the same way that we ask teachers, what is the curriculum this year in in math, we can ask, what's the curriculum this year? What are your goals for the class in terms of how they relate to each other? And I think the more that we as parents in general open those conversations, the more we communicate to schools that things are, these things are important to us and to our children. Now, that said, we then get to the point where, okay, we've done all that, but now something is happening. And as you've said, I need the school to partner with me. We need to figure this out together. How do we do that? Well, I think the phrase that always comes to mind to me is inform, don't storm. That very often, and I totally understand this, a parent of a child who is being tormented or is being made miserable at school, their mother lion reflexes are totally engaged, and they would like to storm the school building and say, do you understand what's being done to my child, and you have to fix this right now. Not only that, but some parents will even go so far as to say to the school, and this is what I demand you do to the culprit, to the perpetrator, to the bully. I never recommend that type of approach. Rather, what we have to do is inform the school and offer to partner. We are experts in our personal child. We know them better, and we are our child's best advocate. The school is expert in other areas and knows things about other children in the school, knows things about the dynamics, knows things about pedagogy and education and all those kinds of things that parents may not be expert in. So our partnership, the more we can each share our expertise, the better it is for the children in our, collective charge. So what I suggest is a call to the school to say, to start out with, not a demand of any action, but to say, I want to share information about something I'm seeing or I'm concerned about or I'm wondering about. And I'd love us to be able to have a conversation and share our joint knowledge. If we put our heads together, we probably each know part of the picture. We put our heads together, maybe we can get a more full picture of what's going on here. If we can, begin
for the
dialogue,
listeners that are just tuning in, we have Dr. Novick, who's a prevention of bullying expert, and we have Gerianna from Paradigm Treatment Center. Dr. Novick, what are some of the characteristics of a bully, please?
So all of the way that we know the characteristics of bullies is from research that's done on very persistent bullies. So while persistent bullies tend to be fairly assertive and aggressive, by the way, bullying can be verbal, so you don't have to be aggressive with your hands. You can just be aggressive with your words. But they tend to be aggressive. They tend to be like being in charge. The cardinal issue, by the way, is not low self-esteem, because it turns out that bullies actually have either overinflated or average self-esteem and average intelligence. What bullies lack is empathy. They literally have a blind spot for feeling the pain of others. They don't get it. It doesn't resonate with them the way that it does with other children. Now, any of us who are parents know that some children are naturally extraordinarily sensitive and empathic, and others, it has to be cultivated. You have to build those empathy muscles. It is a teachable skill. And I work with schools routinely on how do we build empathy with parents? How do we raise children who can put themselves in another's shoes and feel another person's pain and use that information to govern their own decisions and impulses? But it's a process. So the bully at the moment has those characteristics. Now, what I want to just take a step back and say is that that doesn't mean that the kindest, nicest, gentlest child will never act in a bullying way. Sometimes the stars align, they become co-opted by peer pressure or by a group dynamic, and even a child for whom this is not their typical way of operating, they will engage in bullying. It will happen. And one other caveat, one other caution, everything we're talking about bullying is not true amongst siblings. Bullying, as we know it, is between peers. And siblings, unless they're twins, are not peers. And even amongst twins, there's often a slight difference. Every twin knows who was born first. And it may seem like a minuscule difference, but they do respond differently. So we're not talking about this in the home. We're talking about this between peers at school. I want to go back to the question, though, of what do we say to the school? Because I think that it is reasonable.
I wanted to ask you that.
It is reasonable when bullying happens, not just to say, I want to get to the bottom of this, but to say, can we put our heads together and come up with solutions? And at the same time, we have to be reasonable and, most important thing, do no harm. So often, a parent has made a suggestion that at the moment seems like, wouldn't this be great, school, if you would only do this? And it turns out that it would actually have made things so much worse. I'll give you an example. A mom whose fifth grade son was being isolated at recess, and nobody would play with him, was incensed that the school would not allow her to come up every single day at recess and play chess with her son. Now, I don't think that that's a good solution, and I'm pretty sure that a fifth grader having his mommy play with him every day at recess would not improve his social standing. So as much as the mother might fight for that, you know, that solution, it would have made things worse. And other times parents want to, you know, storm into a room and speak directly to the children, the offending children, and say, now you be nice to my son or daughter, or I'm going to report all of you. But then the parent goes away, and they've left their child there as the scapegoat. And it very often makes situations worse rather than better. So we want to do no harm. We want to be reasonable in what we ask of schools, and often to start the conversation by asking the school, what do you think would be possible within the confines, for example, of who supervises recess and what your personnel is like at that time? What might improve this situation? We want to be open to the school's suggestions. The school might say, you know, we think your child would benefit from social skills classes. Or have you tried having play dates over on the weekend to better integrate your child into the class? We don't want to try not to be insulted and try not to be defensive, but to be open to, you know, maybe those things would help. Not that it means the bullying is my son or daughter's fault, but if this would give them tools to handle it, you know, that would be a good thing. And finally, realize that the school may be acting in all sorts of ways on your behalf and based on your suggestions, and they may not be able to tell you that they are for reasons of confidentiality. For example, if Shira and Shira's parents want Jennifer, the class bully, to be given serious consequences for her behavior, it's very possible that Jennifer has been given serious consequences, but the school can't tell Shira or her family anything about Jennifer's punishments by law. They can't. And frankly, Shira's parents wouldn't want Jennifer's parents to know anything that's done to Shira. So you have to respect that the school may be acting in ways really trying to help, and you just wouldn't know it.
That is all rich information that many parents, I'll speak for myself as a parent, Dr. Novick, That's incredibly helpful and insightful. Going back again, though, and looking at the school's typical personnel, all of the teachers, guidance counselors, has it been your experience with the amount of amazing research that you've done and your experience directly with school personnel? Do you think these folks need more information around the specifics of everything that goes into being bullied and then, of course, being a bullier? I'm just wondering if sometimes teachers and guidance counselors are hesitant to talk about it because, as you mentioned, the confidentiality, being mindful of that, of course. But then also, do you find that bullying in particular is a sensitive issue, particularly among school personnel?
Yeah, I think, first of all, knowledge is a good thing, and, you know, more knowledge is better. So I 100% agree with you that schools could often benefit, and many people in schools, and myself included. There's always, as much as I think I know, there's always more that I wish I knew, and that I'd benefit from focusing on. That being said, even knowledge isn't always enough. You know, things happen in the moment. Teachers I don't mean to excuse them at all, and there is no question that many could do more than they're already doing, but they do have quite full plates, and they have many demands on their time. The secondary school teacher, once you start with your differentiated, with the students going to more than one class, you may have hundreds of students who come through your door in a day, and some of them only for 45 minutes at a clip. Learning the social dynamics and who's really starting up and where the whole story or the arc of the story of this happened and how to intervene, it's not so easy. It's not that it's impossible, but it is not, it's not without its challenges. So, yes, more could be done. Yes, there are some schools that are doing their utmost, really are see this as critical to their mission to address these issues, and other schools not so much, that really are much more focused, shall we say, on issues like, you know, academic outcomes and much less on social outcomes. And I think that the best teachers are the ones who are going to say to me, whatever it is I know, tell me more. Whatever it is I'm already doing, tell me what more I can do. The teacher who says to me, there's no bullying in my classroom, this isn't a problem, I don't need to deal with it, I've got it totally managed, scares me a little bit.
And Dr. Novick, going back to a point you made earlier, I believe you shared that your experience has been that you are starting to see a rise in bullying in the lower grades in elementary school, not just in 4th, 5th, and 6th, but sometimes
Correct.
You do see it in the lower grades as well?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And do you think that, I just would love to get your opinion on culturally, do you think that you're seeing a tendency for parents to have an emphasis on math and reading, the academics, and yet we're not really sending the message, and it can be a subliminal message to children that the social skills are vitally important, and
right.
It's not just about your math score. It's not just about being in the 98th percentile as a reader. I just would love your thoughts around that.
Talking about me, does.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure that the issue is a focus on academics. I do think that we are living in a climate where niceness isn't necessarily people's focus. And there are a lot of things that take them away from that focus. Sometimes it's academics. Sometimes it's just our culture is kind of edgy and nasty and not always, you know, focused on doing the right thing as much as doing the expeditious thing or getting ahead, whatever that means, and whoever one steps on their way to get ahead. And I see that, by the way, to a large degree glorified in popular culture and in modern culture. And it's the antithesis of all Jewish thought and belief. That doesn't mean that, you know, we are without our own challenges in our communities and in ourselves, but it certainly is not a Jewish idea. But it is endemic to the cultures that we're living in, the culture that we're living in. And I think that makes it a challenge.
Thank you, Dr. Novick. So the short definition of bullying is repeated unwanted, hurtful, negative behavior against someone. Dr. Novick, can we talk about cyberbullying and what that definition is?
Sure.
And why is cyberbullying so dangerous?
Thank you. So the issue with cyberbullying is, first of all, it's exactly the same. It's the deliberate abuse of power to cause harm to another person. And the reason that it's called cyber, and in some ways I'd almost prefer it be called techno, is that it can be accomplished with any device that has an online connection. And now, by the way, that is more likely to be a phone than it is to be a computer. More young people use their phone for internet connectivity than they do their computer or other, you know, permanent device, other focused wired device. It's all wireless. Why is it different? It's different because it's endless. You literally can't turn it off. It used to be that kids who were bullied felt that they could go home and have respite. And there would be a place of a haven, a place of safety. Now, the bullying follows them home. The bullying can reach them 24/7, virtually wherever they are. And that makes for a very different impact on the victim. It increases the depression and sense of hopelessness. It increases the power, literally the power of the punch that bullying causes. It's that much more devastating. The other thing that's different in the cyber world is it might take me some time to spread a rumor about you, Rahama, if I were going to do it face-to-face. But if I post it, I can hit the send button and hundreds of thousands of people could have it in a moment. So the spread is literally viral. We can send out noxious social connections in a very rapid way. And the third thing that makes cyberbullying different is its permanence. And this is something that I'm finding young people don't understand. Once you put something on the web, it's there. Once you put something on the internet, you know, kids use Instagram and these other Snapchat with the illusion that, well, I sent it to someone and now it's gone. You know, it evaporates in a few moments. Well, but what if that person downloaded it and saved it? Yes, you took it off your Facebook page or you erased it from that message, but another person has it and could distribute it and do something with it. And so it is very, very dangerous. The last thing I'll say is that the challenge for parents and educators is that we are cyber immigrants. We will never know as much as our children do. And in the same way that generations ago, Eastern European parents needed their children to translate English documents for them, and they needed their children to be the go-betweens between them and the government or the landlord or the phone company, we're now in that position with our children and technology. I know. I can't wait for my son to come visit from Israel so he can deal with something in my phone that I don't understand. And he's, you know, not a kid. He's an adult, but still he's the youngest one in my family to help me with those things. And so yes. how do we as parents monitor and educate our children about safe usage of these really powerful technologies of these tools for either social benefit or tools that can wield enormous social harm. How do we educate them when we ourselves are rather naive? And what my advice to parents is, sit with your children constantly. Ask them to teach you. Tell them to show you how Snapchat and Instagram works. And make sure they understand that anything that they are doing on their phone, on their computer, you have access to. Make sure you have access to it. It is not snooping. It is not spying. If a predator can see it, then you, a parent, should be able to see it.
Very important that you mention that. Parents can call MASC at 718-758-0400, and we can offer different solutions to protect your computers. There are companies out there that are very strong protection available. So call MASC, and we can give you different ideas that you can know what's going on your child's phone and computer. Dr. Novick, I did want to add that computers, laptops should be kept in a public space so that parents of younger children doing homework or whatever on the computer, parents should keep an eye as well, even if their computers are monitored by
100%. Rahama, what you're saying is really important. I have yet to find the software or the program that is perfect. And even if it was, it does not relieve you of your parental duty. And I think that it is really important for our children to know that what they're doing online isn't private. It is public, and therefore we as their parents have every right and every obligation to see it. And you should know your child's persona online. You should know. And if they're writing things where the tone is incorrect, then we have to teach them and say, you know what, you may not realize it, but that came across nasty. Because nobody could see your face. You know you're just kidding, but that email that you just sent or that text, that kind of seemed nasty. I don't know if you should, you know, send things without checking. Or, you know, let's work on this together so that your friends don't think you're being nasty when you send them things.
Right. So the parents always should know what websites their children are visiting, and discuss even those families that have a television in their home or listening to music on their iPods or whatever electronics they may be using. Parents really, really need to know what the kids are watching and listening to, because
right.
there's a lot of negative behaviors and words that are being sung on some of these music and television shows that are unacceptable, and kids are learning that. So
right, and keep in mind that again, as I said before, the most common way of accessing any of these programs now and these platforms is on the phone. Saying your computer is going to be in a public place, we have to go further. We have to say, I need to see what's on your cell phone. I need your cell phone every night. I need to check it. We have to be very engaged in our children's technological lives.
So can you give us some vocabulary that parents could say to elementary age children, first to fourth grade first? What should they be saying to their children that their children could know that it's okay to come home and share with their parents if somebody is making them uncomfortable and bullying them?
Okay, so I want to also expand it and say that the one category we've not talked about are the bystanders, and that's the category that most children will fall into. And before we run out of time today, I want to be sure that really I want to speak to all of you parents listening and all of you educators listening and say that the only hope we have of addressing bullying in our communities is by creating a core, a groundswell of bystanders who know in the core of their being that this is not right and know what to do when they see it. So once again, I think the vocabulary we need to give our children, and with young children, by the way, first through fourth, the best way to develop a vocabulary is read books with them, read picture books with them, and find picture books. Your local children's librarian can help you. Find picture books that have bullying in it. And say, do you think the way that they were treating Sister Bear and the Berenstain Bears was nice? What would you do if somebody acted like that in your school? You know, you can always tell Mom about it, or you know you can tell your teacher. Or here's how we can talk about it if someone is not being nice. And if you see somebody doing that, what could you do to help? And by the way, the least likely way to help is to walk up to a bully and tell them to stop. First of all, that's scary. But second of all, it takes an enormous amount of courage. And what bully is going to say, oh, thank you so much for correcting my bad behavior. I'll stop doing that now. I didn't realize. No, it's very unlikely to be effective. But you have other options. Just be nice to the victim. Forget the bully. Just turn to the victim and say, do you want to play with me? Do you need something? I have an extra pencil. Anything that reaches out to that victim at that moment and sends the message to the victim that, A, you're a human being that I care about, and sends a message to the bully that, B, you know, you could treat this person how you want, but we don't do that here.
Right, and I couldn't agree with you more. I just wanted to make a note of this as I'm listening to talk about the bystanders, Dr. Novick. I think it's super critical to point out that children are constantly watching our behavior as adults. And so when we see someone being mistreated at a restaurant, perhaps a waiter or someone that we encounter on the street, and we see some, you know, obvious verbal aggression or bullying or anything inappropriate, mm-hmm. our kids notice when we just walk on by. I know that my 8-year-old, she watches me like a hawk.
Yep.
And we often talk about, you know, if traffic is congested and people are honking their horns, why are we waiting patiently? Well,
right.
you know, because that's the healthiest thing to do, and
right.
it kind of spurs dialogue naturally. Children are naturally curious, and I think the more as parents we try to take advantage of that, and I'm always trying to up my game and improve in that area, but I think it's really worth noting to all of our listeners that you can never forget that children are watching and seeing how we react
Absolutely.
To adults right
and,
when there's
and
an...
And by the way, no reaction, not reacting. Like, let's say we see somebody being very mean to a waitress in the restaurant. Us doing nothing is seen by children as approval. We're driving carpool, and the kids in the back seat are being nasty to one of the other kids. And we just go about our business, and we drive. The kids...
Yes.
hear that. They experience that as if we condone that behavior. Now, I'm not saying that you have to stop the car and leave the offender on the side of the road, or that you have to walk up to a stranger in a restaurant and say, don't talk to the waitress in that way. But exactly as you're saying, we can either say to our children, we can voice the dilemma, we can say, I wish I could go over and tell that man that that's not a nice way to behave. You know what? The next time the waiter comes to our table, I'm going to be super nice to her.
Yes, 100% agree. Couldn't agree with you more.
That's all we need to do. And sometimes all we need to do is in the carpool, in a lighthearted way, say, gentlemen in the back seat there, you're hurting my delicate ears. Please don't talk that way in my car.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be heavy-handed, and it doesn't have to be, you know, a major intervention, but any remarking, anything we do, it's a teachable moment, and to fail at those teachable moments is twofold, because not only do we not teach the right lesson, but we risk our children thinking that this is okay. And that's true for educators as well. I tell educators all the time, you can't have this happen in front of your eyes and do nothing. Because if you do, it's as if you are giving your students the rule book. You're telling them, carte blanche, this is how you treat people in my class. And if that's not how you want people treated, then you can't. You can't allow it. Doesn't mean they get suspended, but you have to say, excuse me, Shira, we don't interrupt people when they're talking. Let's just wait our turn. You know, you have to do something so that the students know the rules of the room are rules of kindness.
Yes, and you brought up the educators, Dr. Novak. Can we speak about how we can bring programs into our yeshivas, into the schools, prevention programs, awareness? What programs are available? And if any of the listeners are interested, they can call MASC 718-758-0400 to reach Dr. Novak. Dr. Novak,
okay,
what is available?
So here is the not good news about that. There are programs available, but even the most successful programs accomplish about a 30% reduction in bullying. And poorly done programs, there's some suggestion, may actually make things worse. That being said, I think the reason for that rather meager impact is I think the problem is thinking of it as a program. If we have students in our third grade who don't read well, we don't do an assembly, we don't bring in a program, we up our educational game. We own this as our responsibility, and we work at it until it accomplishes the outcome that the children deserve and without which we would not be satisfied as educators. That may mean some children will need tutoring and some children will need a special class, and that maybe there'll be some incentive programs for readers and some exciting assemblies, but it's not going to be one thing. And by the way, even if we get them to be great readers in third grade, that doesn't mean that in fourth grade we stop addressing reading. The educational paradigm that we need to apply to bully prevention, we are teaching children to be mensches. We are teaching them to be responsible, to be chayav ben adam l'chaveiro. We are teaching them Hillel's precept that kol ha-Torah kulo, the entire Torah, could be taught in just understanding, treat others as you would be treated. That is not a lesson that is easily taught. And it's our life's mission. It's not something we say, well, we'll do it for 3 weeks, you know, during Sphera. It's something that we really need to give substantive effort and attention to. That being said, the programs that are getting the best attention right now in the general world, there is no program specific to the Yeshiva Day School world that has any data to support its efficacy. The programs that are available in the general world that have the best data is the WITS program, W-I-T-S, which was developed in Alberta, Canada, and the KIVA program, K-I-V-A, which is out of Scandinavia. There is an Olveus program, O-L-W-E-U-S, that was imported from Norway and is managed out of Clemson University in South Carolina, and schools can send someone to be trained. The point is, it doesn't make any sense to embark on a little attempt to address this. Schools have to really ask themselves the question, what are we doing as a whole to address the social climate and to create the social skills and sensibilities of our students? And they really have to look at that from nursery through, you know, their articulated curriculum from nursery through 6th or 8th grade, if that's the school, or and through 12. It has to be a substantive approach.
And do you believe in having signs up in the school that say no bullying zone?
It's like asking, do I believe in posting the speed limit? I think for some of us, it's a really helpful reminder. Many of us need to get the ticket every once in a while to keep us honest. We need to know that there's something behind that sign. It's not simply a pretty wall hanging. If the sign says no bullying zone and underneath it a teacher harangues and humiliates a student, then it's not only not effective, it's ludicrous. If the sign says no bullying zone and a teacher walks past as one student talks in a horrible tone to another student and insults them, then the sign is useless. If the sign is part of a school's embracing, not, by the way, I hate signs with no. I hate signs with no because they're what are called, they follow dead man's rule. If your sign says something that a dead man, that a corpse could succeed at, then it's not an educationally sound approach. Dead men don't bully. That sign doesn't tell me anything about what I should do. Kindness zone tells me what I should do. Mm-hmm. You know, speak with a kind, you know, say a kind word. Who have you invited to sit with you today? Those signs tell me something about what I should do, rather than simply banning behavior and giving me no hints at what you'd like to see instead. So signage, you know, in schools, by the way, that do have a shared culture, that do have a climate of bystanderism where we stand up, we look out for each other, that do have school spirit of cohesiveness and community, then the signage is very powerful and it reinforces it. So I'm not bashing signs at all. I'm just saying that you can't take them alone. You have to look at the big picture.
Right. Now, one of the schools put up those posters and that I was at, and I was just wondering your feelings on that.
It's like putting up a poster that says read. Doesn't make anyone a reader.
Yeah, got it. Dr. Novick, child is school in fifth, sixth grade, being bullied by a girl in her class, and she lives next door to the bully. How would you handle that, where the girl goes home and still it comes home with her?
Right. These are so difficult to deal with, Ruhama, and my heart goes out to the children and to the parents who are struggling with this. And often, even as an expert, all I can do is empathize and say that I feel your pain, and it's terrible. Because there aren't easy solutions, and sometimes it's really being a little bit of an experimenter and saying, well, let me try X and see if that makes things better, and if it doesn't, I'll try Y, and if that doesn't work, then we'll go back to A, and trying different things. It's tempting to go to parents and say, listen, neighbor, your child is being very nasty to my child. As you would expect, sometimes that's going to be greeted because, you know, where did the bully learn their bullying behaviors from? Sometimes that's going to be greeted with not the nicest response, and a parent may say, well, you know, too bad, you know, it's not my job to make your child happy, and right. Things like that. So, but sometimes you will find a partner, and sometimes, you know, the parent will work with you. The other very hard lesson that we sometimes have to help our children with is that we can't change the entire world. We can only change ourselves. We can't, I wish, you know, as a mother, as an educator, as a child psychologist, I wish I could tell every child that you deserve, it's your God-given right to be treated nicely by every person you meet. But I'd be a fool if I promised them that. And I'd be a fool if that's what I parented or prepared them for, because that's not real life in the real world. We as parents have to prepare our children for disappointment, for hurt, for pain, because unfortunately we know that it's likely to enter their lives at some point in time. So sometimes we have to work with a victim and say, listen, as hard as it is and as painful as it is, we need to let this person go. We need to realize they will never be, you know, a healthy, helpful, nice person in your life, and we need to find other people who will, because this is not going anywhere. And it's just too painful and too difficult. Now, that's so easy for an adult to say. I can't tell you how many times the child says, but she's the only, or she's the most popular, or she's the one I want to be friends with, or but she, everyone is, my friend is friend with her, and I, they're all these, you know, impassioned, he's the best ball player, I want him to like me. I know, but we can't make another person change.
And I think, too, Dr. Oh, I'm sorry. I just wanted to sneak this in there really quickly. I appreciate so much. So very grateful for all of your insights. But I know as a child, I experienced bullying very early on in third grade. And my first reaction was to not talk about it, was to hide mm-hmm. it. And obviously that's, you know, the worst thing you can do is not let an adult know that this is going on. But I think it's so key what you say about parents need to be involved. And if you're aware that your child is around children that are being very aggressive with them physically, verbally, whatever, cyberbullying, whatever the case may be, that you do what you just said so eloquently, which is let's look for other friends that are healthy mm-hmm. for you to be around. Because mm-hmm. when you do that, obviously then you're sending the message to your child that you're special, you're worthy mm-hmm. to have beautiful right. friendships and healthy friendships. And so I know, and it was because, you know, being a kid in the 70s when I grew up, I mean, we really didn't talk about bullying in the schools.
Right.
And
right.
so it took me until college, actually, to find my voice. And luckily, I had mm-hmm. some talented teachers and psychologists that I worked with that really helped me get my voice out there. But it didn't go away, that pain, until I started to talk about it. And
right.
that was in my early 20s. And mm-hmm. so obviously if we can take young kids, you know, in grades 1 through 4, as we were discussing here today, and get the dialogue going much earlier and be preventative about it and proactive with the schools.
Absolutely.
And the, right, and the communities, and get it to be a discussion that we always expect to have as we go through our child with them on their school careers. I think that's the, you know, for me, it would have made a tremendous change and difference. So thank
yes.
you so much for your insight.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Dr.
for sharing
Novick.
Your experience.
Thank you, Dr. Novick and Gerianna from Paradigm, Executive Director of Paradigm Treatment Centers. Wow. So basically, it's take all complaints about bullying seriously. Parents need to be responsive. They should take the appropriate measures to resolve the situation by calling the school, reaching out to the school, speaking to the authorities or another parent. Like you said, you had a quote there, Dr. Novick, about schools. When they're to call, they what was that you said?
Inform, not storm.
Pardon?
Inform, not storm.
You got it. Inform, not storm. Because parents usually would run into the office of the principal and complain, and it doesn't work. We know that on the Mask Helpline, 718-758-0400, parents call all the time about bullying in school, and by the time they call the Mask Helpline, it's too late for us to tell them that, because it's usually that they've done that already.
Right.
Stormed into the school.
The one other thing, Rahama, that I just want to kind of add to what you said about take everything seriously. Take it seriously, but also with the grain of salt that we take everything our children say. Children
yes.
are masters of hyperbole. It's always the teacher's fault. It's always someone else. You know, and children don't know the definition of bullying. So very young children will consider that somebody didn't share, you know, their potato chips with me at lunch, they're a bully. We have to take it seriously and investigate and recognize that not everything our child reports is bullying. It may be a social problem that needs our attention anyway, but it may not qualify as bullying. And we that's another reason to reach out to schools for information gathering in a calm and productive way, rather than to assume, you know, it's the worst-case scenario.
Thank you. Very important tonight's conversation on bullying. I want to thank Dr. Rona Novick. Anyone interested in speaking with Dr. Novick, feel free to call MASK 718-758-0400. Anyone wanting to speak with Gerianna from Paradigm Treatment Center, call MASK. We will be on next Thursday night from 9 to 10. We always have special guests on Family Matters. And I want to wish everybody a very good evening and a good Shabbos. Thank you, Dr. Novick and Gerianna.
My pleasure. Have a good Shabbos, everybody. Take
good
care.
Night.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Jay Booksbaum. You know me probably from wine and spirits, but I want to tell you something. Even though I'm in that area of expertise, Rahama Bistritsky-Klapman who runs MASS, Mothers and Fathers Aligned Saving Kids. They're in their 20th anniversary. They've got over 45,000 families that they've helped over the years. It's an amazing program. It's called Family Matters. And if you've got any issues with bullying or alcohol or substance abuse or any other kind of abuse, they're your place to go. I'm really excited to introduce you all to Rahama Wistritsky-Klapman here on Deb Brenner's Talkline Communications Network every Thursday night at 9 o'clock. Listen to Rahama and Family Matters.